The Science Show on RN. When Beethoven invented jazz, it's always seemed to me, in Opus 111, the sonata that revolutionised music again. The question is, could Beethoven have written that without living as he did for 50 years, with all the experience and emotion that that involved? Marvin Minsky from MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, thought a well-programmed computer could have done as well. Emotion, just write the computer code. Here's Minsky in 2003 with a TED talk.
If you ask people what part of psychology do they think is hard, and you say, well, what about thinking and emotions? Most people will say emotions are terribly hard. They're incredibly complex. I have no idea of how they work. But thinking is really very straightforward. It's just sort of some kind of logical reasoning or something. But that's not the hard part. So here's a list of problems that come up. One nice problem is, what do we do about health? The other day I was reading something and the person said, probably the largest single cause of disease is handshaking in the West. And there was a little study about people who don't handshake and comparing them with ones who do handshake. And I haven't the foggiest idea of where you find the ones that don't handshake, because they must be hiding. And the people who avoid that have 30% less infectious disease or something. So if you really want to solve the problem of epidemics and so forth, let's start with that. And since I got that idea, I've had to shake hundreds of hands. And I think the only way to avoid it is to have some horrible visible disease, and then you don't have to explain.
Lots of ideas. Marvin Minsky from MIT, who died in January. But now we have machines like Google's DeepMind beating humans at games like Go and even diagnosing patients. Have we reached a point when Minsky's ideas could be realised? He wrote a book, Society of Mind, giving us a more downbeat view of your Weltanschauung. Here he is in 1988.
The main idea is that our way of thinking about thinking has always been wrong, because we always think in terms of the idea that there's a person inside our head and maybe a person inside that. It's a kind of useless idea. When you say, I feel pain, it's as though there were a little place in the middle of you where everything is concentrated. And I think our culture and our language and all our traditions are around the idea that an individual is a single thing. There's a little free will or spirit or soul in the middle of all this controlling everything. And I think that's exactly wrong. And the theory in the Society of Mind is that what we call a mind is what happens inside a great community of different pieces of machinery, each of which knows very little about each other. The part of you that walks knows very little about the part that talks, and vice versa. People don't know even which muscles they have. Locomotion is very complicated. The same with vision. When you see a lamp and recognize it, suppose you look at some object around the room, like a telephone or a lamp, and you see it and you say, that's a telephone. Well, you're not seeing the telephone, really. If it were the first time you'd ever seen anything of that sort, it would just be a shape. You're remembering the telephone, and those are different parts of your mind. There's a part that maybe finds patches of colors and edges, and there's another part of your mind that finds the name of it, and it seems subjectively that no sooner do you see it than you know that's the thing that rings when someone's going to call you, and when you pick it up, you're going to speak in here, and you're going to put that part to your ear. And we're very confused about this because we don't understand all the different parts of these processes. Well, the theory in this book explains how you could get so many different pieces of machinery, like for seeing and hearing and walking, all to behave as though they were a single individual, the one that we ordinarily think about. And the key part of the theory is that many parts of the brain do particular things, but there must be other parts of the brains that are just like the middle-level managers in a corporation. and they don't walk or talk or anything like that. All they know is what other parts of the brain are useful for. And so most of the mind, I think, is something that we've never suspected. They're middle-level managers, bureaucrats, negotiators, and they each learn things that we have no words for. They learn knowledge about knowledge. They don't learn about anything in particular. They learn which other parts of the mind can be useful for other kinds of goals.
Does that mean that if you can break down these systems in such a way that you could actually create a machine that duplicates them and does something very similar, if not better?
Exactly. I think that even the computers today that we have are capable of acting as though they have minds. And the only reason they don't is that we don't have good enough theories of thinking to program into them. What you have to do is be very bold and make new theories about how words represent knowledge in different parts of the brain and how visual stimuli evoke the memories of other properties of the objects that you're seeing. And little by little, write computer programs that do these different things, then write other computer programs that manage and catalog what the first kind can do and find ways for them to negotiate when they don't agree on what to do. And over the next century or so, I expect that people will put together all of these different kinds of systems and make different kinds of communities or hierarchies or cross-connected networks, and little by little we'll find out how to make the things act as though they think.
I'm going to give you more than just into the next century. I'm going to give you several centuries plus the potential that you think is available in computers. Is it possible not only to make a machine that acts like, say, yourself, Professor Marvin Minsky, but further a machine that is superior in all sorts of performance to human beings? Is that possible?
Certainly. Well, first of all, superior just means something that we admire and don't understand. Because
I said superior in performance.
Well, let me make my position very clear. I don't think that minds and machines are separate things. I think that the human mind is what the human brain does. It's not a magic separate spirit floating by. Of course, we're not used to other kinds of machines doing such things, and that's because the brain is really unique. A human brain has a trillion little parts, 1,000,000,000,000,000 parts. That's a lot. And so naturally you say, well, I'm not a machine, I'm more than a machine. And that's a reasonable thing to say, because all the machines that we've ever experienced, like a automobile or a typewriter, those only have hundreds or thousands of parts. When we talk about something a million times more complicated, then naturally we should expect to do things that are new. Now, it's very interesting how rapidly computers have grown in size, because when I was a school child, there weren't any computers, really. And then we started to have computers with 1,000 parts. In 1950, there were computers with 10 or 20,000 parts. And today, there are computers with literally a billion little parts. The problem is we don't know exactly what the neurons do. I should add that there's probably 1,000 kinds of neurons, so that there isn't just one kind of nerve cell. If somebody says he's built a machine that simulates the nerves of the brain, then that person is bluffing. With some luck, that machine may simulate what some of the neural nets in the brain do, but each one of them is very limited. A digital computer program really can do anything you could describe. So the great thing about the computing machines of today and of the future is that if we understand how a certain piece of the brain works, we can make that computer behave the same way. We can write a program to simulate it, maybe not very efficiently, but I predict probably faster than the brain can. Because although we have a great many nerve cells in the brain, the evidence right now is that it takes a brain cell about 1/100th of a second. That might seem very fast to a person because it takes us 1/10th of a second to do anything. But the interesting thing about our brains is that our brain cells are only about 100 or 1,000 times faster than we are. Units of a modern parallel computer are several million times faster than our brain cells. So even if it takes maybe 1,000 steps of a computer program to imitate part of what a brain cell does, supercomputers of the near future will still be able to simulate pieces of brain in real time.
What would we want these computers for beyond doing the conventional things we know about at the moment? Is there a limit?
Well, we can't know the limit. it's hard for us to think of things that we've never thought of before. We're used to the idea that our human superheroes are the best thing we can imagine. But you could imagine a machine that has a viewpoint about physics that would make it child's play for it to think of the kinds of theories that Einstein did. When we think of somebody like Beethoven, who writes symphonies that we all wish we could write, or Shakespeare, who writes English, and Feynman, people like that, who make physics theories, for all we know, the reason that these people are so rare is that the human brain is not well adapted for that sort of thing. It's hard to think of what evolutionary niche prepared us for being able to do those things. And I can easily imagine a machine that considers Einstein to be a rather poor mathematician and an uninsightful physicist. It might be, as in a wonderful story by Isaac Asimov, he had a robot that was built, and somehow that robot started writing wonderful music, and people admired it so much. And the robot said, well, I better not do that anymore because I'm making people uncomfortable and jealous. But the secret, you understand, is that it's easy for me.
But would it be easy? I mean, let's leave Einstein and go to Beethoven. Could really even a very, very brilliant computer write the Opus 111 or the late quartets? Does that not require to have lived as Beethoven at that time, to have died in 1827 and have had those previous 50-odd years of experience in Vienna, in Germany, etc.?
Mm-hmm. Yes and no. I think to write that wonderful last sonata, one must know maybe 20,000 tricks about human emotions. So if I put it that way, it sounds callous and coarse. But I suspect that learning the phrases and tricks that make people feel things is no more complex, maybe less complex than many of the other things we do. Certainly for a machine to communicate with a person, it would have to learn our language, emotional language and conceptual languages of various sorts. But for all we know, a very smart machine might be able to do that in 15 minutes by skimming through the world's literature and watching all the films and movies and having eyes in the street to see how people behave. Because a person learns these things. Part is instinctive and part is learning. And a child learns in 5 or 10 years a lot about humans.
Yes, but not just intellectually, emotionally as well.
But I think maybe emotions are very simple compared to intellectual things. Part of the humanist tradition is to believe that emotions are infinitely subtle and complicated, but I suggest some people might be interested in the work of Manfred Kleins, who's in Sydney. I guess he's just moved to University of Melbourne. And he has a theory that you might find very offensive at first, because he has described ways of making sounds which make people feel emotions quite mechanically. He has a half a dozen little shapes of sounds and waveforms, and when you play these to people, they feel sad instantly, or they feel happy or lusty. It might be that each emotion is the function of some small part of the brain, and it's rather easily turned on and off. And it's that we are so blind to how these things work that only a Beethoven or a Shakespeare has cracked the code of knowing just what trick of phrasing and intonation will make a person feel very strongly one emotion or another. But that doesn't mean that the thing is very profound. It may just mean that perhaps for our own protection, we have evolved in such a way that it's hard for us to crack that code. Because if a person knew how to make himself or herself very happy all the time, then they might starve to death. And if you knew how to make other people sad, you would disrupt your community. And so I suspect that the reason emotions seem so complex and profound is that we have evolved so as not to be able to control them.
The late Marvin Minsky at MIT, he died a few weeks ago. Was he right back in 1988? We're getting close, maybe, in 2016. And Manfred Kleins, whom he mentioned just now, is in California, still writing. The Science Show on RN.